Today's episode of Robus the Podcast is sponsored by NatureBox. Yes, that's right. NatureBox is back. Tired of eating the same bland food while trying to stay healthy? NatureBox has over 100 snacks for that, because making smarter choices doesn't mean you have to eat boring food. NatureBox makes snacks that are full of flavor and none of the junk. I could pretty much live off of pistachio power clusters. Those the best. NatureBox is great because I need stuff that I can eat on the go in between recording different podcasts, and I don't have time to figure things out of what I'm going to eat next. So I love having NatureBox on hand, and it tastes better than most of these other snacks you're going to have lying around the house, and it's better for you. There's over 100 ridiculously delicious snacks that are made with better for you ingredients. Simply pick out the snacks that you want, and then they get delivered right to your door. I love the coconut cashews. I love the dark cocoa nom noms. Tough to go wrong on the Nature Box. They are constantly adding new and interesting snacks for you to discover each month, and they believe you shouldn't eat something you don't like. So if you try a snack that you don't like, almost impossible. NatureBox will replace it in your next box for free. You can't do that with other snacks. So go to naturebox.com/RHAP. Get two bags of delicious snacks without any of the junk for free. That's naturebox.com/RHAP for two free bags of bold and unique snacks delivered right to you. naturebox.com/RHAP. Get two bags of snacks for free. Hey everybody, what's going on? Rob Cicerino back here with another one of our summer off-season of Survivor Podcasts. And today, I am very excited to have this person on the show with me. I've been looking for an excuse for some time to get him back here with us, that he is one of the co-hosts of the fantastic Dom and Colin podcast. Please welcome back a man with one of the greatest names in podcasting, if not all of humanity, Colin Stone. Colin, how are you?
Wow.
Yeah. Great name.
I've been told I have a power name. Before.
Power name. Yeah. It's almost like, yeah it's like a 50 Shades of Grey character.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Rob. It's a beautiful Sunday afternoon here, not to immediately date this podcast in Maine, which means I'm just on Twitter finding out what's going on the BB18 live feed. So yeah. It's great to be talking to you as always, though.
Good to have you back on here. No fictional character is named Rob Cicerino. Like, that is not happening in any work, no matter what form it is.
I think that's a feather in your cap, though. I think you're never going to run into the situation that I think a lot of people are going to start running into as, like, social media handles get taken. I think you're always going to be the first one there until you get too big to the point that everyone's like squatting on everything in advance.
Fake me. Right. Somebody made a fake me on MySpace once and beat me to my own name, and that was about it.
Was MySpace even big before you were known for Survivor?
No. MySpace got big like right around like 2004, 2005. So I was coming down as MySpace was coming up.
Okay, I got it. I'm sorry. I confused the timeline. Yeah.
Anyway, so Colin, very excited to get into this. We're going to be talking about the anatomy of the merge vote. So excited to dig into all of that with you today. If for some reason you are unfamiliar with Colin and his work on the Dom and Colin podcast, they really focus on a lot of the strategy on Survivor specifically, also The Genius, do a little Big Brother. Most recently, you guys tackled the Brexit.
Yeah. Well, one of us did. The one who is from England and has 2 degrees from Oxford tackled most of the Brexit. I was mostly there just asking him questions, like the ignorant American that I am.
No, that was good. I enjoyed it. It was a nice change of pace. I listened to it right when it had come out in my podcast feed. It came out like on a Friday night, and you guys shouted out Antonio Mazzaro, and I texted him, and he basically like texted me back like, well, boy, you're a pretty big loser listening to Dom and Colin's Brexit podcast on a Friday night. I didn't even want to mention I was also descaling my coffee maker at the same time and watching Big Brother live feeds.
I know. Brexit is right up there with the Big Brother live feeds in terms of just like daily chaos that doesn't even seem possible. Yeah. And by the way, I've really, really been enjoying your BB18 coverage so far. Big shout out to you and Brent and Taryn and Alex and Jordan Parhar. All that you guys have been doing has been really, really fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I thought you guys did a great job with the auction as well. And I like to, I always laugh when you guys get to like, oh, $3.50. Like, no, that's too rich for my blood.
We've had some people go for cheap amounts, it would seem. Natalie, I think, went for 50 cents this time. I don't know. Big Brother, anything could happen, so we'll see.
Let's get into talking about what we're here to discuss today, the anatomy of the merge vote. And now, I believe that you guys are on the same page where Steven and I were coming into Ko-Rong and its merge, where we sort of all were looking at Nick and saying, okay, classic merge boot. He's going to be the merge boot. He did not turn out to be the boot at the actual vote of the merge, like, or had it actually happened if Neil was medevaced, but the actual first vote that took place, then it came around and he became that guy. And we got into a discussion on the podcast over whether the merge boot exists and the politics of that first vote after the merge. So I think that's where a lot of the idea for this podcast sort of came out of.
Yeah, we were definitely on board with you there. Thinking, I spent 3 or 4 episodes in a row thinking it finally had to be Nick leaving, and then it eventually, finally, shortly after the merge was. And there are a couple situations throughout Survivor history like that, where so it, like Joe Dowdle gets pulled, and I'm counting the Brendan vote as the first post-merge vote is what I'm taking into consideration here. Because for me, at least, the merge and everyone coming together into one big group, I've always advocated for being like probably the biggest tipping point within the game. I think it's critical to finally know who's going to be there for this vote, and then if this happens or this happens, who's going to be there next, and you can really start mapping things out down the line. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think that that's an interesting point, that the merge is sort of like an inflection point in any given season where we sort of like have both sides sort of, you know, almost like to, you know, recall the Game of Thrones Battle of the Bastards, that you have both sides sort of, and it's like we don't really know how it's going to play out, and then eventually there's going to be, you know, that first vote is like, okay, you know, show your cards and let's see where this is going to go from here. And it really does set the direction for the whole second half of the season. So I think that there's a lot to learn as we take a look at these first votes after a merge.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think just a great distinction about what makes Survivor different, and like the merge numbers just more powerful than taking numbers early in something like Big Brother, is where Survivor, you can know who's going to be there and who, as long as they stay true to each other, is going to have the numbers to control the vote. Whereas on something like Big Brother, you can hope to know who's going to be there, but you certainly can't know who's going to have power in any given round. So Survivor, you can do it, there's just so much more of a sure thing in Survivor, and the merge is where you can really start to solidify that.
And there's also something unique about Survivor where the game is played in teams up to a certain point, and then this is the first time that then the game changes to not the team game, but the individual game of everybody there at once, and immunity is individual. So there is this fundamental shift in the game that happens at the point in the merge, which I think is what makes Survivor pretty unique in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've always felt lucky that I was not actually one of the day one Survivor watchers. The first episode I ever watched was the Borneo merge, and I was really, really into it, seeing them all come together. I don't know if I would have been so into it, seeing them play in two teams, but I really think the game gets taken to the next level when it becomes individual. I think there's like a lot more excitement in the atmosphere almost.
Okay, so why don't you set up the way that we're going to get into talking about some of these things?
Yeah, sure. So I just wanted to essentially think back through each of the Survivor merges and kind of group them. I'm not going to go through and read them all off in the groups that I have them or anything, but think through what kind of political dynamics and social dynamics they kind of fell into and how the votes ended up going. And the two things that I really wanted to keep in mind when thinking through all of this, that I didn't really notice at first, but in looking after seeing the results at how this played out, are just staggering to me. I wanted to keep in mind just how important the merge round was in crafting kind of that long-term plan like we've talked about, and crafting kind of your long-term group, And the first thing that really stood out to me is when I just looked through the Survivor history at who voted with whom at the merge, voted with whom at the merge, and who wound up at the end with each other, only four of the winners and four of the groups of finalists did not vote together at the merge. Only Vesepia, Chris, Danny Boatwright, and Bob Crowley were not in the finals with people that they voted with at the merge. So it really is just overwhelming first right away that the people who make the end together are people who vote together at the merge.
So Chris, Danny, and Bob
are the only ones, right, who wound up in the finals with people that they did not vote with at the merge.
Okay.
And that they weren't working with. Vesepia did, in fact, vote with the Row 2 group, and she voted against Boston Rob, I believe.
Wait, hold on. Let me just make sure I have that stat down correctly. So it's not that they voted for the incorrect person. It's that they ended up in the finals with people they didn't vote with at the merge.
Right. And along very similar lines, this Vesepia technicality being the only one, the only winners who have ever voted for the wrong side, like been in the wrong side of the numbers at the merge, were Chris, Danny, and Bob. Only three winners have ever voted, air quotes, incorrectly at the merge.
Are there people that they voted for the person who did not go home but then went on to win the game? Yeah, I'm Mike Holloway certainly is one
Mike,
of those people.
You have your Denise Stapley as well voted for Penner, but he played an idol. But in those cases, I am counting, they were both solidly in with the majority of the people. It was just an idol that bailed out the other side.
Okay, got it.
Right, but so, you know, setting aside, like, in the spirit of being with the majority at the merge, it is literally only Chris, Danny, and Bob who have voted against the merge numbers, which is insane, at least to me. Now, you certainly have people like Vesepia again. You have, like, your Natalie Whites or Fabios who, despite voting with the majority at the merge, were clearly not with the majority of people and were going to be in, like, tricky spots going forward. Or you also have people like Natalie Anderson who voted correctly at the merge, but then stumbled for a bit, or like Mike Holloway fell out of favor with that majority. But one way or another, the eventual winner has actually ended up being in on that first merge vote over 90% of the time.
So what you're saying is that we see typically whoever you throw your lot in with at the merge is, for the most part, the people that you would make it to the end with.
Right, exactly. Not only that, but also the people who end up being on the successful side of that critical first merge vote also tend to get to the end and win far more often.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think not only in sorting through like when, how all of these different dynamics play out, I think it's also critical to factor in kind of like what we're talking about with the Denise and Mike Holloway thing. There's obviously going to be a big distinction in the seasons where idols are a concern versus idols are not a concern. So if I can get into just the first group that I have with the idols in mind, and this is probably the most basic, because it works. It's the tried and true game plan, they're so basic, Rob. We are the majority and we are going to take out one of the biggest threats from the minority. And this is without idols being a concern. So the classic example, how about season one? We have Tagi who wants to go for Greg. He wins the immunity. So it's Gretchen instead. What are you going to do? It's the tried and true. They knew it right away. We have the numbers. We can just maintain these numbers. There's nothing they can do about it except potentially win immunity to ruin that for us. So let's just take out the people who are most likely to do that.
This is really where the team part of the game has so much significance, where if you go into the merge with the numbers, you're going to come out. The winner is coming from your group.
Right. Absolutely. And we see, if I just in looking through these, a lot of the seasons that fell into this, like Oma Tepe, I think, fell into this category with the Matt Elrod boot at the merge. Just It's senseless to keep him around. Boston Rob, I'm assuming, figured it was senseless to keep him around. Let's just ride this majority. And we often see pagongings come out of this kind of situation. And that's because it makes sense in far more cases than not to just pick off the opposition. And then one of you is going to win.
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, Survivor 101. You go into the merge with the numbers. It's the kind of thing that really started to build Survivor up in the beginning. And I think it's the kind of thing that almost, you know, careened Survivor off of the cliff, where you get to Survivor 22, 23, 24, where you had just these groups with a majority coming into the merge and then just, you know, picking off the other side, and where we started to have the rise of the three tribe format to sort of combat this. And, you know, pretty basic,
right? As we've said, I'm sure both of us said many times on the podcast airwaves, good Survivor is often quite boring, and a lot of these seasons that are in this category are quite boring.
Yeah.
Thailand would be definitely one of these seasons. Karamoan, where Cochran and Stealth R Us seemed Brenda and Ice Cream Scooper Eric had the choice and they just went with the easy one rather than going with the Malcolm and Corinne Rebellion. which was actually quite a great analogy for that season as a whole, I would say. But this makes sense for a reason. Like, this seems to historically, if you are one of the people at the center of the onion, as the Alliance is often described, this is the move. This seems to work out way more often than not. And in many cases, you can just keep repeating the same tactic over and over and could just bringing up a different person as the biggest threat each round after round until you and your friends are in the finals together.
So in terms of seasons that have a numerical advantage for one side versus the other, do you see a pattern with the person that goes home in these seasons?
Overwhelmingly, I would say when the majority has the choice of who to send home, we'll talk about them going opposite directions, like voting on who's most annoying or who's least likely to have an idol played on them or whatever. But it does seem like typically the conventional wisdom is go for the person who's going to cause the most trouble for you later.
So that's a physical threat in terms of winning the challenges, or is it other types of threats as well?
I mean, yeah, you certainly have like your Nick Stanberries in there, your Brandon and Bobby
John
getting. Yeah. 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 I don't pretend like everyone listening doesn't vividly remember Nick Stanberry, Rob. But you also have people like, for instance, Alina in Survivor Nicaragua.
Alina!
Where they thought maybe she's not necessarily, not only not the most popular, but
the
just kind
squirrel.
Of a... That's right. That's right. The dirtiest, squirreliest, and also biggest troublemaker, potentially.
Yeah.
Incidentally, just quickly on the Nicaragua season as a whole, are you a Sash defender? I know Steven is.
So, yeah, well, I think that Steven has a personal relationship with Sash, that Sash became like honorary wine and cheese, I think, after Survivor Nicaragua. And he seems like a pretty nice guy from the times that I met him. But I don't have like a real personal connection with Sash in the way that Steven does.
Okay, I wasn't sure because it stands out to me when I hear Steven, whenever he rarely brings up Sash, he always seems like really eager to defend Sash.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure what it was about.
He's just friends with him. I think that's really what it is. I mean, with these people that when you're friends with them, then it's like, oh, no, you don't know. He's really a good guy. And it's like, okay, well, you know, he's won you over, but for whatever reason, he was not able to win over these other people who played with him for 39 days.
I think I'm somewhere in the middle. I think I'm tempted to be kind of a Sash defender. I do really feel like, I know this has nothing to do essentially with the merge. I do feel like Jane Brett really got in his way potentially there.
Yeah. I think that there's a lot of stuff that's going on there in that Nicaragua merge. But, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, between your Dan Lembos and people like that, you know, that he didn't get any of them on his side. So I feel like it does speak to something. But I think there's also some sort of like a zero vote brotherhood that's happening as well.
That's also
solidarity from the zero vote finalists.
Is it brotherhood without banners? Brotherhood without like fanners?
Brotherhood without
like
ballots.
Yes, exactly. That's perfect. I think there's also a reason that not a lot of podcasting gets done about Survivor Nicaragua these days.
Probably not.
Yeah, but just to reiterate, I think these are typically going to be the least exciting kind of situations. And as I said, often lead to some of the more boring seasons. But it's because it's just fundamentally sound Survivor and it does seem to work. And it is fortunate that in just looking at my list, it's been a while since we've had seasons like this. Like Karamoan's the only one in the last 5 years that would fall into this category for me.
Yeah, we get it. I mean, for Survivor, I think that they got it too, where if you have two sides and don't do a swap and don't go down to like go from two tribes to three tribes, certainly, especially with first time players, people are going to just stick with the people they've been working with for 19, 20 days and seldom will become, you know, very intermingled after the merge.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think production, I'm total tip of the cap to production for kind of breaking out of that mold. I think you hit it right on the head, that run of 22, 23, 24. Maybe it was almost good in retrospect that it was such a blatant indicator that something has to change.
Yeah, and there was a point where the swap was even, you know, had become passé, where they really decided to really from, I mean, how many swaps did we end up seeing between, you know, Token Sheens and up until, I think, One World. I mean, we swapped, I think, in Nicaragua, and I think that was it.
Yeah, that sounds right. I want to say Cochran put it out there somewhere that he read online that both Redemption Island and South Pacific were supposed to have swaps.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what happened there. But I think maybe that was a change of plan. But for whatever reason, I think we have demonstrably seen that swapping and starting people in three tribes definitely leads to more active game dynamics and a much better season overall. And I think that lesson has solidly been learned.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, somebody probably is going to get screwed because of it. But then, you know, that person was sort of like a sacrifice that was made to the survivor gods. And then we end up having typically a better post-merge.
Yeah. So along similar lines to this kind of idea, I also have the category of they're not the biggest threat, but the majority has the votes, of course, and they just have flexibility. And they're voting essentially based on annoyingness. Not a ton of these, but like Clarence from Africa. You could probably argue he was a big threat, but this is Boron turning on themselves, or like Amy and the women going for Rory and Vanuatu, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which is not really, as far as I can tell, a big difference maker. It's not like going for Rory is what cost the Women's Alliance in Vanuatu the game. They had the right idea to be pregonging anyway. So that's not a real difference maker either way. I think the more interesting examples, Rob, that I want to start getting into, and the first one of those is an OG deadlock with the very first rules about tiebreakers where you have the previous votes rule, and that is the merge in Australia, yes. Where we have this blatant 5-5 Cooch and Ogacore split. I want to start off by asking you, because this has come up on my podcast before, because Dom is a defender of the previous votes rule for a tiebreaker. Was that the worst idea in the world, do you think?
No, I don't think it's terrible. I think that there is something to it where you have, you know, people are getting these votes cast against them. I think that the problems with it start to be, one, how are we tracking that? Because I think that sometimes that there are votes that are unread and you don't necessarily know how that's going to play out. And then you have these scenarios where you get into that, you know, you have so many different votes and then idols and stuff like that. I just think it would be increasingly complicated for the viewers to be able to track. It would be hard for the players to track it during the game. And I think that for the people at home, I think it's also hard to track.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think Dom just likes it from like a game theory perspective. It adds an interesting wrinkle to it. But when this was in fact the rule, and again, we don't need to spend a ton of time on this because it's not like it's going to be the rule ever again, because, and we'll get on this later, I think rocks are just a much better tiebreaker in general. But I thought it was just interesting to see how these tribes approached it. First of all, Ogacore apparently knew that Jeff Varner had one vote against him.
Yes.
Do you know the backstory on that? Because I've never been clear on this.
From what I understand, that when they did the second challenge in Australia, they did a reward challenge. And I believe it was Tina who said to Kucha tribe, like, who did y'all vote for at tribal council? And Kimmy was like, yeah, we all voted for Debbie. And then Deb voted for Jeff. And Jeff Varner was like,
well, just bit my ass.
Yeah, it was Kimmy.
Okay. Yeah, I thought Kimmy was somehow involved. That's right. Now I'm recalling hearing about this during the whole season 31 buildup.
From that point on, the game was altered.
That's right.
It's a game altering move.
That's right. Some yes. Game alterers definitely solidified.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think also another interesting wrinkle to this was Ogacore going with the idea of having Colby kind of act like a jackass. I thought that was really cool too, because they knew that he had no previous votes against him, and to try to like, hey, Jerry and Keith, how about you kind of just shut up for the next few days? Let's not let on how kind of annoying and past vote getty you would be.
Yeah, Ogacore actually really played that all very, very smart in terms of how they did it. They had like the men went over to Kucha and the women went to Ogacore, and Jerry, even though she like kind of got annoyed that Keith took the matches with him, she had to like sort of like grit her teeth and not really show that how much she hated Keith. So they all played it pretty well.
Totally. I just thought that was a really fun merge to kind of just talk through, just because, again, much like Nicaragua, now that Survivor historians are past it, not a lot of Survivor Australia podcasting going on these days.
Not much. Not much.
But and you're through the evolution of strategy, by the way, too. I shouldn't sleep on that.
Yeah. Well, it's still out there, but yeah, we're not going back to revisit it anytime soon. But I think that what was really fun about this, though, is that it really was all in at, you know, final 10. And it made the next 5 weeks and five rounds of voting, pretty boring and predictable, but it was very, you know, you were, this was the line in the sand.
Can I confirm something that I've been actually meaning to ask? At Run It Up Reno, is it true that Boston Rob won the All In or Fold tournament?
He did, yes.
That is the most perfect tournament for him to win. It is amazing that he won the All In or Fold tournament.
Hey, Colin, smarten up. Yeah, he did. He came in and he sort of was like just sat down and he like just arrived at the tournament. And basically it's, you know, every round is all in or fold up until I think the last two tables might have been just like a regular, you know, hold'em game. But I think that he did win that. And yes, that his game does speak to all in or fold.
If I fake tweeted that as like predictions for Run It Up Reno, that would be too predictable.
Yeah, yeah. Although it's not so much all in or fold. It's more like his game is like all in or bust. I think it's right. Really at that point. It's really it's just all in, and either he's going to win or he's not going to win.
That's a good point. That's a really good distinction.
Like, there's no fold. There's no retreat in his game.
That's smart. I mean, you shouldn't be folding in Survivor. He's definitely smart, I think, oftentimes, to be standing his ground.
Yeah.
Rob, the only other...
A couple people folded in Nicaragua.
They sure did. They sure did. The weird thing is, it was, like, checked to them on the turn, and they just, like, decided they were just out for free. They had nothing to lose. Right.
Yeah.
So the only other one that we don't have to think about idols for is your merge in Amazon that I wanted to ask you a couple of things about, because this is one that stands out where a lot of people, perhaps everyone, thought that they were in the majority entering this merge. You are, in fact, the swing vote here between your new Jabiru tribe and the guys back from your original, forgive me for forgetting your original tribe name, Tombaki?
Tombaki.
There you go. How do you make this decision here? What was going through your head during this?
Well, I think that the Amazon merge speaks to a different type of merge that we have, where instead of where it's the original tribe majority has taken hold, this was a swap tribe majority taking hold. And we see this, I think, that Guatemala is also like this, where for whatever reason, the original tribes, that structure did not hold. It was hollow. And then the swap tribe just hit it off better and said, hey, this is the new group. And so we come into that merge and our swap tribe was like, hey, let's stick together. And because the Butch and Roger and Dave felt like that the original tribe was still holding together, that was the thing. We were easily able to pull Heidi and Christy back over because they were like, okay, well, we're obviously not with the original Tombaki group. And that's how we ended up with, you know, a 7-3 majority at that point.
Well, if I'm recalling correctly, you rallied the troops before you even merged. Like the night before, you said, okay, we're down to 10 people. We're about to merge. Let's set this game plan. Here's the real plan. And then here's the fake plan to tell Roger and Dave. What went into like just that kind of double agency for those 3 days? Did the guys continued to think that you were with them, right? Like Roger jumps off the stump at the immunity challenge.
Yeah, we decided to make Roger feel like that he was going to be comfortable. It was just that for me, I felt like, okay, I'm not in the any higher than the top five. I'm not in the core group of being with Roger and Butch and Dave. Like, I know if I stick with those guys, I'm going to be out, you know, relatively, you know, I'm not getting to that final table there with those guys. So I felt like, okay, well, let me go in with this other group. And that was the reason for me. And then there was, you know, other reasons where, you know, it was kind of, you know, fun to get one over on Roger. And then the women didn't love him either. So it was just on all the levels. It just made sense for everybody involved.
Oh, did you have some fun at Roger's expense?
Yeah, I think we might have. That's
well, not feeling like you were going to be sitting at the final table with Roger and Butch and Dave, how far ahead were you planning as you were thinking, okay, I'm going ahead and voting those guys out now? Were you already at this merge trying to start making plans or deals with like Dina or Alex or whomever for down the line this early on?
Yeah, the deal I had made with Dina at that point was, I think it was probably during the events of, like, it was right after that swap. So I forget if it was either in the fifth episode or the sixth episode, but I really was very taken by Big Brother 3. And I really love the Daniel Reyes and Jason Guy plan. And I came into Survivor of the Amazon. I said, like, oh, this is a good plan. I'm going to want to, like, partner up. Like, I wanted to be sort of the Jason guy in that scenario where I wanted to partner up with a woman who was sort of like a middle-aged woman and just sort of like have a deal with and then sort of just like be like trading information back and forth. And nobody would suspect that we were working together as Danielle and Jason did with great efficiency in Big Brother 3. And so I really did hit it off with Dina. And she also happened to be a big reality TV fan like myself. And so we talked about that and she's like, oh, this is a great plan. And we were sort of like, you know, I had something going on with her. And then also, you know, I hit it off really well with Jenna at that point and also with Alex. So I didn't know exactly what the answer was to who I was going to go to the end with, but I felt like I had, you know, a lot of different allies and probably Alex was still my closest ally. Just he starts to go off and become like really infatuated with Shauna at that point in time. All of a sudden everybody starts to lose their mind over Shauna.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what major lessons did you feel like you would want to impart, like, about the merge in general, just from your own experience, if anything, like, stands out?
Well, I think that in some ways where going skipping ahead to somebody like, you know, Kim really did a great job of just having so many options after a merge. And I think that you want to at least have that first vote go by the board and just lose somebody who you know you're not going to end up working with. And for me, Roger was a good person in that where I knew there was no scenario where I was going to the end with Roger. And even though he'd be a great final two goat, there was just no scenario where I was going to be able to go that far with Roger, where I was going to be in his plans to be able to work with him. And he wasn't really the kind of guy who was flexible and like, hey, just tell me what to do. It was sort of his way or the highway the whole way through. So there was really no way I was going to be able to make that work.
Yeah, definitely understandable. So I think, at least for me, that as far as not having idols in consideration, I think we've basically hit the fundamentals of that. I think it's largely just keep it simple. If you're in the majority, maintain that majority. Take out the people who could disrupt that, because there's very little else that anyone can do.
Yeah, and the swap thing is something that complicates it. And I think in that, it's like, okay, make sure your majority actually is the majority.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. All right. So I want to get into where we have idols in consideration, where let's go back to the idea of just the majority wants to vote out a threat from the minority, but now they have an idol to worry about. And I want to start with Survivor Fiji, where I think some really important kind of like concrete was laid here. Where again, this is another one of those examples where technically they merged and then they like divided at the immunity challenge into two new teams. Which was still technically the merge, but only half of them went to tribal council. And Michelle Yee got totally screwed to leave. I'm not counting that as the merge vote. I'm counting this as, right, yeah, completely. I'm counting this as it's the new Moto tribe and Dreams against the three horsemen that Dreams has just sold out, essentially.
Okay.
But the complication is the big majority knows that trio, that the three horsemen now, have an idol. And this is what we get to. This is where we see the first instance of what we call on our podcast Edgardoing someone. This kind of what in poker would be called like a leveling war of trying to figure out which of rock, paper, or scissors your opponent is on, essentially, where we want to vote for the biggest threat, but then they're going to play. They might just play the idol because that's who we'd obviously vote for. But we know that they're going to play the idol on the biggest threat. So now we'll vote for the least likely person. And Edgardo is the person that they landed on and being the least likely to have the idol played for them. And this kind of like, not revolutionary, but as I kind of said, like it lays the groundwork for stuff that we'll talk about down the line as far as how this leveling war progresses, as far as threat levels and who to put votes on and who to play idols on when these kind of situations come up.
Yeah, so you have to start to get inside the head of your opponent of who has it, who doesn't. Now, how does this change up the target after the merge?
Well, it could change it drastically. Like as we'll see, in certain situations, if it's a tie, like in South Pacific, where the people that you vote for are potentially going to be immune, do you want to be voting for a threat? Or where you know the other side has an idol, do you want to be voting for the biggest physical threat? Because that's probably the person they're most likely to play it on. It completely comes down to putting a much bigger priority on understanding the people that you're playing against and what their motivations are going to be.
Okay, so how do you want to explore this? Are we looking at this as what is the best way to attack this? Or are we looking at it as, you know, who is the right person to put your idol on?
I think the best, what I'm considering is when you're the majority, the best plan of attack in general, I guess, when you are the majority, because presumably that's where the winner is going to be coming from. Over 90% of the time is someone voting with the majority. So in the case of Fiji, I would say we certainly can get into which person to play the idol on. I think the bigger question is the majority alliance trying to figure out where the three horsemen are going to play the idol. And the three horsemen, for just the refresher, are Mookie, Alex, and Edgardo. And Mookie and Alex, I think, understandably would be predicted as probably the people who would want the idol played on them more. So the majority votes for Edgardo, thinking he's going to be the least likely to have it. And we see this come into play down the line, where, for instance, the heroes versus villains merge. Parvati is trying to figure out who she thinks the heroes will have voted for, so she can give her idols to them. And she thinks they will be doing, like, the opposite math, so she gives her idols to Sandra and Jerry, potentially as a result of this Edgardo vote, where now that the precedent has been established, it completely opens the floodgates.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry if I'm explaining this poorly.
It's a lot to explain. We have a lot of numbers. We have a lot of idols.
Yeah. Another similar situation, as I've referenced before, would be like the South Pacific merge, where the Savaiis are trying to figure out who the Upolus would not want drawing a rock, so they idol Whitney, thinking she's like the middlemost person involved, like trying to play the guessing game. It really adds a whole different twist to how all of these merges go down. Yeah, but I don't know. I think a couple others that I have just kind of fitting into this, if we want to look at season 19, I know Foa Foa ends up being the power players there, but at the actual merge, it's certainly still Galoo who's in charge, and they end up taking their shot at Eric Cardona. In season 30, the idol disrupts it when they want to pick off No Collar, but then after Jen plays the idol, regardless, they're still able to pick off the rest of No Collar. So I feel like the overwhelming thing here is when you're in the majority and you still have an idol to be worried about, but you know you want to pick off someone from essentially the minority, just bite the bullet and take the shot, I think is the overwhelming message.
Okay, so do you feel like that has the conventional wisdom shifted, or shifted and shifted back to the point where, if hypothetically speaking, we're in an alliance and it's the merge, and we have our group of four or five people, and we know the numbers are coming for one of the people on our side, but we have an idol, are we playing that idol for the person in our alliance who is the least threatening, because we figure, okay, they'll never think we're putting the idol on them? Or has it shifted to the point where they know we're thinking that it could be the person who's the least threatening, so they're going to go for now the person in our alliance who's our Joey Amazing in the alliance with us, because of course that's where we'd go, and that do we protect him, or is it just completely random at this point?
I think we're getting to the point where it's completely random, and like, yeah, in that scenario where, say, you have an idol and you need to hit it correctly to like even up the numbers for the next round, potentially, it's largely going to come down to how selfish the person is who is technically the owner of that idol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or maybe not even necessarily how selfish, but what level that person is on. Like, potentially, like we've seen Russell not be selfish when he plays his idol pre-merge on Parvati, but if he had just been on the wrong level there, he could have looked like the biggest idiot ever and been like the third one out or whatever.
Right, that's a fun thing to factor in. So we sort of like have to say, okay, who is the most likely person to find an idol? So we're sort of looking at like who can sort of like climb trees and stuff like that. Like if Ty was on this alliance, we'd say, okay, well, he's probably a likely person to be digging or climbing or anything like that. So probably that he's a factor if we're going to be looking at who to target. And then probably the person who's like the least likely to have it, let's rule them out. So it's like, I think we would want to target, again, if we were reversing it, probably the person who's just like the most like in between.
Yeah.
in this game of Battleship.
You're right. It's like the Office clip. This is probably an obscure reference, but Dwight talking about the murder mystery where he knows it can't be the person he most suspects or least suspects. So we just got to go in the middle and hope we're right with one of them.
Go in the middle for somebody who seems unlikely to be a person who's finding the idol.
Exactly. And the way, yeah, we always frame it as the person least likely to have an idol played for them, whether it's them finding it or whoever owns it playing it on them. The same way, like when we talk about the Savaii idol, we're probably talking about Jim Rice as someone who probably wants to be involved in where that idol is getting played.
Yeah. So in this scenario, we're looking for the most ordinary, the most Julia Landauer person in the group.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think just again, the overwhelming message for me was in looking at the spots where we have, especially in these 12 and occasionally 13 person merges when it's a big group that comes together and they clearly just have a mutual incentive for now and they want to pile their votes, but they are worried they can't account for all of the idols. The best bet is to just stick together and bite the bullet and go for it rather than turning on each other.
Okay, that makes sense to me.
Yeah. Galoo, by the way, it was one of those tribes that decided to turn on each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sounds about right.
So I think another really interesting category, and I think now we're going to be getting into the more interesting, like, actual merge discussions themselves, is another one, much like yours, Rob, in Amazon, where everyone thinks they're in the majority. And to me, I would say Tokenshin's is one such example of this, where the Timbira tribe is ostensibly up 6-4, but they all hate each other and want to work with Jalapau, and Jalapau is telling all of them that they're all cool. So these are always really, really fun. Or like in the Philippines is another one of those. Kim Spradlin, as you just referenced, it seems like everyone was feeling at least partially good there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I want to first of all, just get into the Tokenshin's thing quickly, because this is another one where Joe, as I mentioned, gets medevaced at the actual merge. And I'm not counting that as the merge round. But I do want to quickly just on that. I am of the opinion that that's like the best thing that could have happened for JT, Steven, and Taj. Are you on board? I feel like going from 4-3 and being viewed as a smaller but trustworthy unit is right where they want to be.
Yeah, I think it got them closer to that intentional Matt Singh scenario. So we don't necessarily call it an intentional Jalapau, but I think that you could make that case.
Well, it's interesting just because everyone seems to, with the exception of Brendan and Sierra, want Brendan out here, but they again know that he has an idol and they also choose to bite the bullet. And then the rest of Timbira just crumbles on themselves. It's pretty amazing to watch play out. Or in the Philippines, there's just total chaos until Penner and RC find themselves on the outs and Penner idols himself. But blood versus water is another good one where everyone kind of feels like they're in the middle and Tyson and Jervis are the decision makers. And I think the larger point for this one, is don't get too comfortable. In virtually all of these seasons, when everyone is feeling good, things tend to change. I know Tyson and Jervis may be a bad example because they're the ones calling the shots there. But generally speaking, these are things that get shifted around. Like season 32 may actually be a good example of this as well. Where again, Neil gets medevaced, but then after the Nick boot, things are still constantly mixing around.
Right. If you don't know who the sucker is at the merge, it's probably you.
Right. Or even if you do know who the sucker is at the merge in this case, when everyone felt like they were in the majority and it was a crazy blindside, it could still be you the next time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So those are always really, really fun. And interesting, just to move on to the next category that I have here, and this is the only one that qualifies, and we've talked about it a little bit, but a deadlock with idols in consideration, and that is potentially the most famous merge of all, and that's the heroes versus villains merge, and Parvati's decision here. We know we have these two groups of five, the heroes against the villains. She has told Amanda on the heroes that she herself has an idol, which I think is very, very critical in how she makes this decision here, because she knows that Amanda's going to tell the heroes and they're going to know that Parvati has the idol. And they also know that JT gave his idol away to that side as well. So they have to be hugely worried here about who to put votes on and who's going to get idols played on them.
Really credited, I believe, as if not the best tribal council of all time, but one of the top three. I believe it was voted into the Gordon Holmes Survivor Hall of Fame, even.
Oh, was it?
I believe so.
That's right. They started inducting like tribal councils, right?
Yeah. There was 1 year. Yeah, 1 year.
And was it like Snakes and Rats was in there?
I think so.
It must be.
Yeah. I think this was up there.
Yeah. Well, I think this is just another interesting example of, as we kind of talked about with Fiji and the Edgardo vote, just that leveling war of what Parvati ends up wanting to do, where she has two idols. She knows she has two idols, but she's still the one who gets to play them. Like, she is essentially trying to figure out which level Amanda and the rest of the heroes are going to go on. And she arrives at the opposite conclusion that the Three Horsemen arrived at, where she gives her idols to the people that she feels are the least likely in their minds to be receiving idols in the minds of the heroes, and thus the most likely she should be giving to in Jerry and Sandra. And this is, I think, another move that just cements Parvati as one of the best players of all time.
What's really interesting here is also that Danielle has individual immunity. Parvati is able to deduce from Amanda Pokerface Kimmel saying to her, hey, you should really play the idol on herself. I forget why she was able to rule Russell out, that they weren't going to be putting the votes on to Russell. And she just realized the only two people it could possibly be are Sandra and Jerry, and she's going to play an idol on both of them.
I've never heard her talk about how she ruled out Russell, but the answer might be they knew the heroes would not want Russell to be the safe one if it did go to drawing rocks.
Yeah, I don't know exactly. I'd have to go back and rewatch that episode.
I mean, it's critical that I had forgotten that Danielle had the necklace. You are right. So it does make the decision at least somewhat easier when it's only, and she knows pretty reliably that Amanda was lying to her about the votes being on her. But it's still really heads up stuff to be putting the idols there on Sandra and Jerry, by the way. And it was such a surprise to them too, even. It was great. I think the most interesting examples are the ones very similar to these where it's close to a deadlock, but not quite, where there are two very clear sides and there is a swing person in the middle. And the first that I want to talk about, it's not Bollocks, it's Jonathan Penner caught in the middle here in Cook Islands between a thin majority and a Tyler Perry idol.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Yeah. I was stuck in a no-win situation.
I think he really was. I think that was the issue is, I think Penner... fundamentally, and it's worth bearing in mind that I don't know if they saw Terry Deese's idol the first time, but he does know about Yule's idol and what it does and how powerful it is. And I think he had the right idea. And the justification that he gave on the show for flipping was, if you want to make the final four, you need to be with the person who has that idol. Because again, this is a Tyler Perry idol. This is an insanely, I'll say, overpowered idol. And he decides to end up flipping, turning on his old tribe over to the I2 people. And the issue is he's turning it from 5-4 one way to 5-4 the other way. He does that on the condition that Nate is the one that they end up voting for. But as we'll see be a theme that develops as we talk through a couple other merges like this, the people are not quick to forgive and forget the person who does that.
Yeah, well, Penner really was in a bad spot at that merge vote because Yule basically tells him he has the idol and then eventually shows him he has the idol and says, hey, you have to vote with us or we're going to put our votes on you. And then you guys, then you could vote for me, but then, you know, you'll be the person out of the game. And he even goes back and tries to say to his alliance about, like, I believe that Yule has the idol. And they're like, no, Penner, you're so stupid. Like, we checked out the Exile Island. There's no idol there. He doesn't have it. It's like, I'm pretty sure he's got it. And like, no, get out of here, Penner. So that he's really, like, what was he going to do? He was going to go out of the game. And he was like the hostage in this, like, either come with me or you get it.
Yeah, I think Penner, this is a good illustration of a pretty fundamental survivor concept, I think, in a lot of seasons where if someone feels like they've lost the game, but they're in a position of influence, they're going to go with the people they like more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we see that, I guess, with jurors literally quite often, where they have lost the game and then now they want to go with who they like more.
Well, then I think that Yule did a good job of wooing Penner over to his side in that spot. And then, you know, I think that Penner might have felt like, okay, well, let's vote out Nate because I know that he doesn't like me. At least all the other people were on my original tribe. Maybe I still have options, but they were not too quick to forgive him.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of potentially for me, the most interesting merge vote ever is South Pacific and Cochran being the odd man out on the Savai'i tribe since very early on and then being faced with the decision to go to rocks or not against what is very clearly like this rock solid Upolu tribe.
No pun intended. And I think,
right, yes, thank you. That's right. And I think a couple of things are worth considering here. First of all, in Cochran's spot. And this is something that we interviewed Cochran. We talked to him about this for probably half an hour. And so I'm hopefully remembering what he told me correctly, more or less. But I think there are several things to consider here when you are in this kind of Cochran situation. And the first is that he was feeling like no one on Savai'i really wanted to work with him, even if he did stick with them. Like at the Papa Bear vote, Jim Rice wrote his name down because he was afraid Papa Bear had an idol. So he wanted Cochran to be the blowback
vote.
Cochran,
I got an idol. Trust me, it's real.
Yeah. So he was definitely, understandably, not feeling great about the Savai'i people.
Yeah.
I think go ahead, sorry.
No, I think that this is fascinating. I don't recall if I've ever had a real in-depth conversation with Cochran about this point in South Pacific. I feel like I've talked to him more on the podcast about Karamoan than this, but
I can't imagine why. It went so well both times.
Well, you know, we did our sort of exit interview, and then I feel like the next time we talked to him, we were, you know, we did a recap, I think, about like the beginning of One World, and then we had him on the podcast where it was during Kagyan, and so maybe we might have been talking about more Karamoan at that point. I'm sure we talked, I think we probably compared Cass in Kagyan and her flip to what Cochran ended up doing in South Pacific, but we spent a lot of time on this in the evolution of strategy about his thinking.
Well, I'm definitely happy to, I'm excited to get into it. because he definitely understandably is not thrilled about the prospect of like an all Savai'i endgame. That is totally understandable. Yeah. I think the bigger considerations are, first of all, this is months after they just watched Boston Rob bust out the buddy system on Redemption Island, and now they show up to the merge beach and Coach is the only one allowed to talk to anyone on Savai'i. And all Coach is saying is that there's absolutely no chance we're going to budge. And the other thing is there were two necklaces given out this round. There was a male and a female necklace won by Ozzy and Don respectively, as well as I mentioned earlier, Savai'i did play their hidden immunity idol on Whitney. Upolu did not play their hidden immunity idol. So Cochran, when facing this decision after the first vote about whether to go to rocks or whether to end the tie, the decision is we would potentially be going to draw seven rocks, and the only people from Savai'i who would be drawing a rock are me and Jim Rice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Versus five people drawing rocks from Upolu.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, and I want to preface all of this, not even preface, but put out there that there's certainly plenty of risk. There's a 14% chance that he draws the rock. There's another 14% chance that Jim Rice draws the rock. But at least for me, when Upolu is that, again, rock solid, hit the bell, don't do it because it's pathetic, that there's no consideration. You cannot ever let them take firm control and just leave your fate entirely in their hands, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and the way that I sort of looked at it after the rewatch that we did of South Pacific is that for Cochran, you know, Coach comes to him and they make a Final Four deal with him, which in his mind like may be real or may not be real. And this is, I believe, the best round of play that Coach has over three seasons of Survivor, where he ends up getting Cochran to come on board. For Cochran, it was probably, you know, not super dissimilar to like what I was thinking at the merge in the Amazon, where I know I'm not going to the end with this group, that I'm not in anybody's plans over there. I know that Jim Rice has said, well, are you kidding me? Of course I was taking Cochran to the end. But who knows? I don't really know if that's anywhere in the episodes, you know, and Stephen Fishback will tell you the exit interviews are not always canon. And so, you know, for Cochran, you know, he takes a big risk here. And I think that in conjunction with him being such a big character, parlays that to a return to the show. I'm not sure if any part of that was in his mind at that point in time of, you know, if Cochran is, you know, the person who picks the rock, the merge boot in Survivor South Pacific, does he get invited back for Karamoan?
That's an interesting timeline to go down.
I mean, sure, Francesca is there, so you could say that. I don't know. Is he necessarily, like, did he do enough to guarantee? And some people would say, of course he was going to come back, but you don't know that for sure.
I mean, what better way to come back, though, than to be the guy who forced rocks?
Well, but what if he's the person who gets voted, pulls the rock?
Then, hey, bring him back. He pulled the rock. He got screwed. He needs a second chance.
Yeah, I guess so.
The thing for me is, When we did talk to Cochran about it, and this is, we talked to him a few months after South Pacific finished airing. This is long before Karamoan happened.
Right. You couldn't get him now, right?
No. I mean, who could you?
No.
No. What he said
is, getting harder.
Yeah. No. I mean, he took, after Karamoan, it took like Bill Simmons like 3 months to get half an hour with Cochran. But anyway, he said to us, he said, I acknowledge that mathematically it was a horrible decision. I am unwilling to put my hand into a bag for my one shot on Survivor. It's not going to happen. I will not draw a rock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to me, that's I just couldn't fundamentally disagree more with that kind of approach, which I made clear to him in a very dickish way that I feel bad about now. I don't know. I feel like it's understandable on one hand, like especially when he's thinking that's his only chance. And why am I risking my life for these people who since the beginning have blatantly treated me as an outsider? To me, it is because you are, first of all, extremely unlikely to lose that rock draw. And secondly, if you don't do this, you will be viewed as, and correctly so, torching the entire game for you and your entire tribe.
But I think that sort of speaks to the beauty of these types of games like a Survivor and Big Brother that we get to talk about, is that it's for some the strategic argument will ultimately be the decision maker. But I think that more often than not, it's the emotional argument that you need to make. And it's sort of like the understanding of how these, you know, five or six different people in your alliance tick. And Coach was able to make that emotional argument to him to win him over, which made so much more sense of like, you're Hercules, you're going to be part of our alliance. You're going to stand up to the bullies. They're going to draw a line in the sand. You're going to come over with us. And then, you know, that was all that Cochran needed to hear. It didn't matter what the numbers were.
Yeah, definitely. Your coach is really on point today. I'm really digging it.
It's okay.
I really like it.
I think I just surprised you with it.
I have a question for you in just thinking about this scenario, I think I would actually be somewhat open to, because I was thinking about what if I was Jim Rice in this spot, and because we talked to Jim as well, and he brought up the idea of what Cochran should have done is say, guys, I am not willing to draw a rock, but if you play, give me an idol or give me one of the necklaces, I will happily force the tie. I was thinking short of that, if we do get to the rocks, can Jim say to Cochran and say to Jeff Probst, I want to draw the rock for him, like I'll draw two rocks. Would you be okay with that?
I think that that's probably too much of a game alterer for the show, and who knows what that changes in Jim Rice's future. But I don't think that they would allow that. I think it's
I don't think they would either. But I think it should be. I think if I was production, I would at least be open to the idea, especially because I think the ruling should certainly be you can promise to draw the rock for someone, but then once the tie is forced, you do not have to go through with it.
It's interesting. I think that maybe that is something that the creative team could take a look at, but I think that it probably is too much of a fundamental shift for the game. I mean, could you have somebody who's just like some sort of like a kamikaze on your team that'll draw the rocks for everybody? It's somebody who wants to quit anyway?
I mean, everyone who's drawing one rock pulls it and the other person takes the whole bag that's left or whatever. That's probably too extreme. You're right. I guess you're not sending this to Samoa, Rob?
No.
Okay.
No.
That's fair.
It can go to Topaz's baby shower.
Okay. Any other final thoughts on Cochran? Because I just have one more merge that I wanted to talk to you about.
No, I think that the Cochran thing is really fascinating in terms of, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, when you have Ogacor and Kucha, where everybody is sort of, even heroes versus villains, like everybody knows which side they're on, everybody is loyal to the cause, and everybody is moving in the same direction, and it's easy. But I think that the Cochran thing, and again, that was a 12-person merge where you had six people on both sides. I think that that was harder to, you know, make sure that just because that, you know, your buffs are all the same color, it doesn't always mean that your interests are mutually aligned.
No, I'm with you. And this last one that I want to talk about is actually an 11-person merge. And before I do, are you more of a fan of the 12 or the odd-numbered merge?
You know, I haven't thought about it a lot off the top of my head. Do you have the seasons that are the 12-person merges and the seasons that are the 11-person merges? And I can
I believe Samoa was the first one, and Heroes vs. Villains was 10, but it went Samoa merged at 12, Nicaragua merged at 12, mm-hmm. Redemption Island and South Pacific merged at 12, I think One World merged at 12, Philippines merged at 11, Karamoan merged at 12, I don't need to go through the whole list, sorry.
The Cambodia was 13, I believe, at the merge. I think that for me, I probably side with the larger merge. If anything, I feel like any season, I'm like, hey, let's merge sooner. I feel like we can't get to the merge. For almost any given season of Survivor, I find that the part of the season I enjoy the least tends to be from post-swap until we get to the merge. I feel like you get a little bit of a swap bump, but I kind of feel like that there is a point, especially where they do three episodes from the point that the swap goes on. Karamoan, I think, is probably the worst. Everybody like really craps on the first like four episodes or so, or first four or five episodes of Karamoan until Brandon Hance leaves. The worst part of Karamoan is from when Brandon Hance leaves until we get to the merge. I think that sometimes it's just really, you know, you have where it's people that want to are trying to throw challenges and stuff like that. You know, there's always some excitement. Okay, who's in the swap tribe? But I kind of feel like the dynamics of the post swap tribe, I feel like can be a little boring. Or you have a season where there's no swap, and I feel like, okay, it's sort of just like a foregone conclusion. You know, this episode 5, episode 6, I think sometimes can drag. And then especially if you get to episode 7 and there's still no merge, you know, it can be particularly, you know, starting to drag. And I think that we're just like, okay, let's just get to the merge where it can be much more unpredictable. So I'll say merge earlier.
I totally am on board with that. I think actually that's a great point. I think regardless of even or odd numbers, I would say merge them just with more numbers. Yeah, like heroes versus villains. Didn't it take to like episode 9 or 10 to get to the merge?
Yeah, and that was really
That's
an exception. I feel like that if you were going to say what's the worst episode of the season though on heroes versus villains, it might be the vote where it's the, you know, the villains are trying to decide you're going to vote out Sandra or Courtney. I think that that is probably where the show starts to drag. Although it is a fascinating argument in hindsight of, you know, what happens to Courtney if she, like, if they decide to vote out Sandra in that spot and Courtney stays, is it Courtney that goes on to win the game?
It sure well could be, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I know. But anyway, let's merge them earlier because I think it makes things more unpredictable. And to me, I was thinking about this earlier about, you know, what kind of season do I like? And I think that to me, I think that my perfect Survivor season is unpredictable, but with one person who is sort of driving the unpredictability as opposed to just a total crap show where it's unpredictable, but nobody knows what they're doing. And I think that where one person knows what they're doing to the point where they just have everything on lockdown is also boring. I like unpredictable, but with one person as the driving force.
Well, then, Rob, you're going to be very excited to talk about the final merge that I want to get into with Survivor Kageyan.
Yes, because I know that both you and I are Team TV.
Very much so. Very, very much so. And this is where we have first Sarah in the middle and then Cass playing Kingmaker between
the president.
That's right. Not only the president maker, between the Tony and LJ side and the Spencer and Tasha side. And this is really, really fun where as they hit the merge, everyone thinks that they're selling out to get Sarah. It turns out eventually that Cass is going to be the one more willing to flip. And the interesting thing here, as at least for me, is the idols. Once you know about, you potentially may or may not even have Cass on your side, but what you do know is that you have a lot of votes coming your way. You're Tony. You don't even know LJ has an idol, but you're feeling pretty good that it's not coming on you because they've done the whole the other one after you flashed it. Now you have to go into that decision of what level are they on? Who is the other one? Who is their backup plan?
Yeah, this Kageyan merge, and I really applaud the order that you've taken us through all of these because it really combines everything where you have, we have two groups on each side that are very much locked in, which are post-swap groups, which are sort of the combined version of, we have the brains with Sarah and Morgan and Jeremiah left over from the Beauty Tribe. And then you have, you know, mostly Braun plus LJ and Jeffra over there. You have a swing vote in Cass, who is like the Cochran figure, even though her side, again, much like Cochran, doesn't know that she's about to flip over. You have a immunity idol. So this is very exciting. A great, great merge episode.
Yeah, especially when you have to factor in that they have idols, that they, both sides have idols that they can't account for. And it's when Tony starts flashing his idols at Tribal Council, the same way I sort of hit on this when talking about how Parvati told Amanda about her idol during, you know, Poker Face Kimmel during that whole discussion, where just the fact that Tony knows that they know about his idol and he can now see how they're responding to that to kind of aid his decision is really, really fascinating stuff. Now, I would take issue with if Tony feels like he was the first one and now they're scrambling to say the other one. I think there are a couple of different ways that he could go here. I don't know if LJ is the way that I would end up going with my idol.
Yeah, well, this is also bringing into this conversation of who do you play the idol on, which we also talked about earlier. And so that's really where I believe the fallout comes from with Sarah, where she wants to put the votes, because it seems like that she wants to, as to bring it back to this idea of, could you keep your options open, that Sarah wants to put the target onto, she thinks it's a dumb idea to put the target on Jeffra, I believe, right?
Right. She is positive that Tony cannot possibly have an idol.
Yes, yes. The president has great instincts in terms of what she wants to do.
Executive order. Tony does not have an idol.
You know, there's a lot of dissension in the ranks in terms of what does Sarah want to do versus, you know, Tasha and Spencer, what they're saying and what Cass is saying.
Right. Cass is feeling neglected because no one wants to hear what her opinion is because all they care about is getting Sarah.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, I think, you know, when you are the Spencer side, and the, you know, the brain side, I suppose, you do probably just don't want to do whatever is keeping Sarah happy, right?
Yeah, you want to keep her back in line. And Cass says, like, hey, everybody's worried about keeping Sarah happy. Nobody's worried about keeping me happy.
That's not going to fly.
Yes, you have to keep Cass happy. That's really one of the most important things about working with Cass.
Yeah, well, to get into that angle of it, and the three that I had separated into this, where we have Penner, Cochran, and now Cass in the middle of making the decision. To get into the moral of that story, I think people can remember how all of these seasons played out for those three people, where they were immediately and irreversibly viewed as essentially costing themselves and their entire side the game. You do not want to be the person making this kind of flip, just to get that out there immediately.
So just with the help of the Survivor Wikia, which is much like Andrew Savage, I use it as a great resource for a lot of the things that I do, according to the Wikia, so that Jeremiah was pushing Jeffra would be a good target, and Sarah said that it should be either LJ or Wu. That's where she thought, where she wanted to go.
Uh-huh. Okay. Because I know Jeffra did, in fact, end up being the other one. I know Spencer was also pushing really hard for it to be Jeffra as well, and she became the backup plan that they eventually went for.
Yes, and as it says here, Sarah says that that was a terrible idea and proposed Tony as the backup vote for Wu.
Right, I think, yeah, that's what ended up going down, I believe, is they went in planning to vote for Tony. Tony then busted out his idol. They said, go to the other one, and then put their votes on Jeffra.
Okay. Yes. So really the side with the brains, plus Sarah, plus Morgan and Jeremy, they ultimately did have it right. And Tony and LJ did both waste an idol at this tribal council, but it was only for the moving over of Cass to their side that they did ultimately. Like, I mean, this was like a football game in the final 2 minutes where, right, shifted a bunch of times going back and forth.
They like both teams kept running it back off the kickoff. It's amazing to think about that from like the brain's perspective of the Braun people get up and play two different idols. They miss on both of them, and you are right on having put your votes on Jeffra. And then on the last vote, it turns out that Cass flipped on you anyway, and it all came crashing down. It's amazing.
It's a weird tribal council in a very unusual season where there's like clapping where, okay, it's like, okay, it's like a Family Feud where, okay, like, hey, good answer. Okay. Play the idol on Tony, play it on LJ. Okay. Good answer. Okay. And then we start getting the votes and it's like Jeffra, like, oh, you know, and they're excited. But then, you know, there's that sixth cast vote for Sarah.
Can we get Jeff Probst and Steve Harvey to just switch jobs for one season just to see what it would be like, or one episode, just to see what each show would be like going the other with the opposite host?
The winner of Survivor Ko Rong is Aubrey. No. Okay. Still a great night.
Yeah,
still a great season.
I don't want to skip over LJ's idol decision here too, because Tony gets up and plays his idol, and then LJ, after having an idol played by Tony on him, decides that he wants to return the favor and cover Tony's ass as well. And Tony says to him, you shouldn't have done that. And I think this is probably the idol that we could potentially find the most fault with, where it looks like Tony has deduced, based on his own idol, that he did not feel like he was in jeopardy. I'm wondering, if he could speak up and say, LJ, don't play this on me. Play this on one of the girls.
Yeah, well, I think that this is also the vote, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Tony stands up and goes to Jeff and is like, Jeff, could you verify this idol for me? Or could you could you validate this? And Tony, I believe, says at this point that I read the room and I saw everybody, that they seemed like that they were happy that I got up to play the idol, so I played it on LJ. So he felt like that he got a second, like two shots at this. And I think that LJ, I think, was just guilted into the like, boy, Tony's gonna be really mad if he finds out that I played an idol. Like Malcolm wouldn't care about if somebody played an idol on him and he had one, but LJ's like, oh boy, Tony's not gonna like this.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. That's exactly right. I just think it's funny that Tony seemed pretty confident that he was gonna be safe there, and that LJ, I think you're totally right that it seemed to be just like a guilt trip. Like Tony would be mad. I think we would both probably be on board, though, that Tony would probably be the last person he would want to be playing his idol on there. Maybe that's results-oriented of us to say. But It seems like if Tony felt like there was a reason to play an idol, he would have just used it on himself.
So LJ just didn't want to be that person where Tony is going nuts. Like, what do you mean? Why did you make me play my idol on you? Because Team TV.
For sure. Forever. So I don't know. Just to kind of wrap on just all of these merges in general, I think this has been really good. Just in, before I even sorted all of these into these categories, I had no idea what any of these kind of like findings would be. And as I said off the top, I was floored at just how often the people who ultimately found success in the game were on board with the merge vote. It's amazing to me, regardless of what different kind of merge vote it was. That was the one constant, is the people who were successful were in on it.
Is there any sort of takeaway from this Kagyan merge, and maybe even specifically from Tony and Sarah in the way that they may have modified the game following this?
In what kind of sense? Certainly in the never count on who you think you could potentially count on sense, I suppose.
Okay. Do you feel like that there's any way that the way we should look at the game has been modified by Sarah?
Oh, unequivocally modified by Sarah. And I would feel it would be an injustice.
Transformed.
It would be an injustice for her to not get that kind of credit.
What's our big picture just takeaways from this in terms of how people who are going to be playing Survivor 35 when they're listening to this on their iPod at Ponderosa, in terms of what they should be thinking as they approach day 18, 19 of a future season?
Right. My big takeaway, and I'm, again, just a big advocate of this for this in general, is until you hit that merge, I would be very reluctant to be locking many things in just because of all of the uncertainty that still lies ahead. We could swap again. I don't know what the other tribe's going to be doing. Once you hit that merge, I would say that is the day that you really need to start thinking about your end game and start planning out how this is going to go, barring a circumstance like a Cambodia or something like that, where you know, or like a Philippines, where everyone's all over the place and you know that all you want to do is just stay on good terms with people and just stay on the majority for now. And try to develop bonds for going forward, where it's just impossible and unrealistic to try to lock anything in. Mm-hmm. Once you hit that merge, be ready to play hard, I would say. I think is the overwhelming takeaway for me, is the merge is much more so than I ever even realized before, probably the most critical part of the game as far as setting up how you want things to progress for you.
Yeah. We really outlined like why it's so important that you have to be right on this merge vote, because it really shows that you are moving in the right direction. If you get this right, it's very hard to come back from it. If you're wrong from this, only a couple people have been able to overcome that. And it used to be so easy to just get it right at this point in time. You just, as long as you had the numbers going into it, and as long as it wasn't a tie, you were going to be probably, you know, headed in the right direction. And then you just have to sort of like figure out the power structure of your own group. But here, now in the case of Cass and Cochran, you have to make sure everybody in your group feels good about what you're doing, and everybody is sort of like all on the same page and all of your interests are aligned. And then you also have to do the detective work of figuring out where the idols are and how you ultimately are going to, you know, crack that nut of trying to figure out this shell game of where the idols are hidden.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's absolutely, you're totally right. It's, again, like I've been saying, for me, so many considerations now. Like, long gone are the days where you show up with your starting tribe and you hope to take majority and then just pick everyone off from there. There's so much going on. But even in this modern era, even after having spent almost 20, probably 20 plus seasons now, with hidden idols in play, being right on the merge is just critical. And part of that is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, once you get the merge vote right, the numbers then shift more in your favor and you're better set up to get things right. Of course, that is kind of almost like a natural selection thing. But as we just even much more so than I ever realized, it is astoundingly hard to recover from a bad merge, as far as I can tell.
Good stuff all the way around. Colin, you know, I have you here, and you know, I just have been looking forward to getting you back on the podcast just to talk about a couple of different things. So how are you feeling about the Aubrey and Michelle of it all from coming out of Survivor Koh Rong?
I'm of a few different minds about it. I'm first and foremost, for sure, just glad to be done with the season and glad to have the whole truther debate over with, for sure. And I hope I know plenty of your listeners probably were not thrilled with all of that and how prevalent all of that was. I very much hope that we never have anything like that again. I on one hand, certainly feel bad for Aubrey. I don't want to take anything away from Michelle. I very much enjoyed the interview that you did with her. She had a lot to say that I was really interested in, and she was much, honestly, much better and more insightful than I was expecting. You did a great job with that. I still do feel bad for Aubrey. I don't know really what history is even going to say about Koh Rong as like when we look back at it in 5 years. I really am curious. I'm not convinced, I guess, that it's going to be the medevac season. I think it's always going to be that Aubrey and Michelle thing.
Yeah, I think that there's probably going to be a big part of that. Because I feel like that the medevacs, I mean, even just like so close to where we are now, where it's like, okay, it's been like, what, 2 months since the season has been over? Or no, not even, like a month and a half. I mean, are you really thinking about how Neil and Beast Mode Cowboy and Joe went out of the game? I think that probably the one lasting one is probably the Beast Mode Cowboy thing.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I don't know. I think it's going to be really interesting to think to go a season to go back to potentially a couple of years from now as more things play out and we see more just Survivor and more of the modern era. But I don't know. I think it was a fun season overall for me. I definitely, I believe I would still probably have it near the bottom of my top 10, baby. I really enjoyed the season as a whole.
Wow. Single digits for Koh Rong?
Maybe 10, 11, 12, somewhere in there. But I understand that for me, I watched from episode 5 forward virtually certain that Michelle was going to win, and that didn't change my enjoyment of it. Like, while I just kind of took for granted that that was going to happen, but wholly uncertain, and people who listen to our podcast regularly will know, we were way wrong about virtually everything else that happened there. I still had a ton of fun trying to unpack how it all happened, and I think the reason, as I was getting to, that it's so high for me is because I was not devastated by the Michelle thing.
Well, I really did enjoy the coverage that you guys did over the course of the season. Your episodes tend to come out at a good spot during the week for me to listen to stuff, because just in my own production schedule, I typically will record, you know, the first couple days after. And then at least this past season, the podcast that I did with Josh Wigler and David Bloomberg, I would record them on Sundays, and then I would listen to the stuff that you guys put out on Monday once I sort of got done talking about Survivor for the week. I really did like to hear what you guys were saying about the episode as well, and sort of like compare it to the stuff that we had that had come out of the shows that we had done. So I did appreciate all the coverage that you guys did, and good job with all that. You know, I am curious though, you know, I don't know if I've ever heard you guys talk about this on the podcast in terms of how did you ultimately end up getting into podcasting about Survivor?
The Borneo merge was my first ever viewing experience for Survivor. Our first ever podcast about Survivor was not intended to like start a recurring podcast. It was Survivor South Pacific, that merge episode we just thought was super, super interesting. And for some reason, we just felt compelled to do a podcast about it. And then the plan from there was we were going to, at the Final Nine, talk about do a podcast about all the famous Final Nine flips and stuff like that. And then at Final Seven, talk about all the famous Final Sevens, which we did during South Pacific. And then it wasn't until One World that we decided to actually start doing regular episode coverage. But the way that Dom and I met, which people are typically more curious about, is we were both just low stakes amateur poker players who are members on a poker website called 2+2, where on there, it's the biggest, by far the biggest, like, gambling and gaming forum out there for English speakers. And on there is a TV forum, and within that, there's, like, a Survivor thread. And during Survivor Nicaragua, we were both just posters in there. And just for those next couple of seasons, whatever, commented back and forth. And then when the South Pacific merge rolled around, Dom was the one that we got together and said, let's do it.
And you guys have never met in real life, correct?
No, we have not. He's been to America once. I have never been to England.
And when he was in America, you guys didn't say like, we have to figure out a way. No, come hell or high water.
No, we did not say that. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to like diminish your question, but just knowing Dom, no, of course we did not say that.
No,
he was in like Atlanta or whatever. And I'm in Maine. Okay. So, I mean, who knows? I wouldn't even be able to estimate how likely it is that we ever meet.
Wow. Oh boy. And do you ever do the podcast on video Skype? Have you ever done the show and see each other while you're doing it?
We can see each other every time. We can always see each other. It's the audience who can't see us. The only, if you want to see us, the only video podcast that we've done, I believe we did, I think the video one got posted of us with Dan Giesling. We did a podcast with Dan.
Also, mazel tov to Dan Giesling.
That's right.
And Chelsea Giesling, who brought baby Desmond into the world. Big brother,
He'll see you in another life, brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, congratulations to Dan and Chelsea as well for all the positive baby news. But really do enjoy everything that you guys do over on the Dom and Colin podcast. Have you been enjoying the Big Brother 18?
I've been loving the Big Brother 18. I got my live feeds. I've been absolutely into it, which is for me. Entering at least Big Brother 17, I was ready to just not even watch the season. Of course, we had the Genius 4 going on last summer too, so it was a lot easier to skip it. But this season, I think, has been fantastic. And I think the reason for that, at least as far as I can tell, is we have a house full of people that seem to want to be playing Big Brother and just seem to be trying to play hard, but no one's that great at it. It's not like we have these returnees. It's not like we're putting, as was rumored, Derek and Vanessa in there to just steamroll people, or like a Boston Rob on Redemption Island situation. This is, as we've compared it to, the Bobby John returns. Like, he was there the first time. He's a fun, familiar face. He's going to contribute to the show, but he's not going to overpower everyone. And I think virtually all of the returnees fit into that mold.
I don't have anybody that I'm particularly just like really in love with. Like, I don't have a major favorite character or anything so far in this cast, but I feel like the season has been fun.
I got to give it up to not only Frank, but to Ian Terry, who during our auction draft was all in on Frank, essentially. Frank, I think, has been really, really tremendously improved so far.
I spoke to Ian recently and I told him I thought what a good job he did with you guys on the auction. And I felt like he really thought he ran circles around you guys.
He killed me. Ian absolutely killed the auction for sure.
He knows what he's doing.
He knows his way around the Big Brother house.
Yeah, so good job by Ian Terry. All right, Colin, do you have a hashtag for this podcast?
Oh, God. Of course I know that you're going to ask me this question, and I don't have one. I'm sorry. Do you have any written down?
How about Brexile Island?
How about that? Let's do it.
In honor of your hours and hours of coverage of the Brexit with Dom.
That's perfect. Thank you, Rob. It's such a treat always to talk to you.
Yeah. But anyway, if you haven't checked out Dom and Colin podcast, where do you go to listen to that?
We are on iTunes. You can go to domandcolin.com. I'm on Twitter at Colin Stone. Dom is at Dom HRV. And Rob, just before we go, because I don't think I said this off the top, I am so, so thrilled that Post Show Recaps got the podcast award. I don't know when this is coming out, but this is still relatively new news to me.
Yes, and thank you.
I'm not kidding. Post Show Recaps, my favorite podcast. I don't know where I would be without you guys getting me through Game of Thrones every week. I got into Justified and The Leftovers because Josh and Antonio were covering it. Now probably certainly in my top 10 baby shows of all time. Loving everything that's going on over there. You guys and the whole gang, everyone over there.
How about the Mr. Robot? You follow Josh and Antonio talking about Mr. Robot?
I'm all over it.
Okay, good, good. Well, anyway, that if you haven't checked out the Dom and Colin podcast, definitely check it out. I think it's a very nice compliment to everything that we're doing over here in terms of all the strategic discussion. I feel like that you guys do not do the lowest common denominator, which I do appreciate. And I think it's a very interesting show always.
Well, very much appreciated. It certainly couldn't come from a higher source of compliment.
All right. All right. Well, let's start to wind this down. Otherwise, we'll never get off the line. But very excited about this upcoming week. I'm going to be headed to Chicago to go out to the podcast movement. But this weekend over at DePaul University, we have the RehabCon coming up. We're going to be doing panels on The Survivor and The Big Brother. I think probably about like 20 tickets or so are left at the time that we're recording this. You can go to RehabCon.com for more information on that. Plus, we've got all of the Big Brother 18 coverage coming up as well this week on the podcast. Although I will be in Chicago, Jordan Parhar will be subbing in for me on Wednesday and Thursday. Ian Terry will be a guest with Jordan coming up on Thursday. So lots of fun coming up here on the podcast, and hope to see a bunch of you guys out in Chicago this weekend at DePaul. So take care, everybody. Looking forward to hearing what you guys have to say in the comments, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care. Bye.